Hello, and welcome to episode 25 of the History of Yugoslav Football podcast, and the second part of our series on Yugoslavia's golden age, from the Avala to the JNA. In the previous episode, we went from 1958 to 1960 with the national team, as they not only took part in the first ever European Championships, they broke the Olympic hoodoo that had dogged the side for over a decade. In these next two episodes, we will look exclusively at club matters in the nation as power begins to swing between sides. Just after the 1958 World Cup, Sven and Zvezda were due to play a friendly at home against CDNA Sofia. Prior to the game, a buildings inspector came to their ground, the Avala, to conduct a routine inspection. What he found were rotten beams and signs that the ground was seriously structurally unsafe. The Avala itself was not a young stadium. It had originally been built in the 1920s for SK Yugoslavia, before entering into an expansion and refurbishment plan in the late 1930s that would end up with the stadium half finished and running empty due to the beginning of World War II. At the end of the war, it would end up in the hands of Sven and Zvezda, and the refurbishment would be botched to completion. Zvezda were left with a large dilemma. What to do now? What they did was end up ground sharing with none other than Partizan, with smaller games being played at other venues until a permanent decision could be made. That permanent decision would, eventually, be to level the Avala and build what would become the Maracanã on the same spot. That would be a massive technical feat, given the Maracanã was to be far larger than the Avala, require them to dig foundations over 12 metres deeper than the Avala, moving a quite incredible 12.5 million cubic feet of material in the process. The Maracanã itself would not be ready until 1963, with an official capacity of 95,000, near enough double the Avala. The Maracanã is a little ahead of us at this point, but it's worth establishing at this point the complications that the next 5 years were about to herald for Sven and Zvezda. Groundhopping, while also helping to fund a project that would go massively over schedule and over budget. And this was a Zvezda side looking to regain their title that Dinamo had wrested from them in the 57-58 season, having to do so away from their home and do it in a reformed league. For manager Misa Pavic, entering his second season at the club, it was time to prove himself. The first league itself was now a slimmer affair, with just 12 sides, and the goal ratio system had been dispensed with in favour of the far more recognisable goal difference system. It will be brought into use quickly. Dinamo's honeymoon as champions would be over quickly, with them dumped out of the European Cup in the first round by Dukla Prague on the 1st of October. Their consolation would be that their side would make up more or less the entirety of the Zagreb side in the second Fairs Cup, while the Belgrade side would be a fairly even mix of Zvezda and Partizan. This edition would be the last to go across two separate seasons, and the penultimate one to feature an amalgam of Yugoslav sides representing their cities. Perhaps, unsurprisingly, they would make light work of their first round opponents, with Don't Call Them Dinamo Zagreb beating Hungary's Újpesti 4-3, and Lausanne falling to the Belgrade All-Stars 11-4. Which is about as many goals as you'd expect a team with a front four of Milutinovic, Kostic, Mitic and Sekularic to score over 180 minutes. Both of them would then meet English opposition in the second round in the spring of 1959. Zagreb would lose 4-3 to eventual runners-up Birmingham City, while Belgrade would hammer Chelsea in OFK's Omladinski in Belgrade to go through 4-2. They would eventually lose their semi-final to the winners of the competition, Barcelona 4-2, as the competition inexplicably ran to its conclusion before settling on a considerably more sensible format as we hit the 1960s. The opposite would be the case of the swiftly losing relevance of the Mitropa Cup, which kept its post-season status both in 1959 and 1960, a year when it would make an ill-fated move to just having six teams from each competing nation play off in a two-legged tie against each other before declaring the most successful nation the winner. Surprisingly, this wheeze did not work wonders in restoring the competition to former glories, and as we're about to hit the point where second-tier clubs are going to start being entered into it, it's best to leave the Mitropa to one side for the majority of the 1960s, until we reach the 1970-71 edition and the beginning of Selekcionice's extraordinary run in the competition, after which point the remaining 20 years of the competition will be able to be wrapped up in short order. But back to 1958 and the First League we go for the meantime, a season which would almost mirror that 1951 season, where then Dinamo managed to throw away the title in the most unlikely circumstances. This time it would be Sveinas Fiesta who would be cast in the role of leaders swiftly returning to the pack. They would start the season on fire, demolishing a still in the doldrums Hajduk side 7-0 in Belgrade and hammering Dinamo 4-0 3 weeks later. Their autumn record was 9 wins and 2 defeats, but, crucially, with the vast majority of their away games still to play. Those came into reckoning as soon as Fiesta returned. In their first 7 spring games, they would win only once, suffering losses to Vardar, Hajduk and Partizan. Meanwhile, Partizan, who began the spring 7 points behind, started to motor. With 4 games to go, Zvezda were level at the top with Partizan, with Vojvodina only a point behind. In those last 4 games of the season, neither side would face each other, and each side would finish with 4 successive wins. Zvezda would win the title on goal difference from Partizan, with Vojvodina a point behind and the rest nowhere. Radniki Belgrade, Dinamo and Velez Mostar would be the closest competition, and even they were 8 points back. For Sveinas Fiesta, it would be part of a double, stealing the cup against Partizan 3-1 in the final. The Partizan side that day would feature in their first final Milutin Soskic in goals, a 19-year-old Fahruddin Yusufi, and Milan Galic. These 3 men would be the first of Partizan's babies, a generation we will become very accustomed with over the next few episodes. They would not be the only change at Partizan that season. After 13 years of playing in blue and red, 1958 saw Partizan finally adopt the black and white stripes that would become synonymous with the club over the coming years. At the bottom of the league, Vardar would be detached and Zelyesnikar would join them in being relegated, to be replaced by OFK Belgrade and, making their debut in the top flight, Sloboda Tuzla. At this point, the second league settles down for a decade into 2 regional competitions, East and West, with the winners of each conference being promoted. Vardar would bounce back the following season and be back in the league for the 1960-61 season, and they will stay with us in the top flight in occasionally controversial fashion until the end, for almost the entirety of the remainder of our timeline. RNK would join them in welcoming in the 1960s with a promotion. And so, it becomes time to do away with the 1950s in the podcast once and for all. The season marked the last season prior to a major changing of the guard. This season would be the one where Real Madrid would win the last of their consecutive European titles, with the classic final against Eintracht Frankfurt that so often features in best games ever lists. As for the European Cup as it pertained to Yugoslavia in the 1959-60 season, Sveinas Fiesta were in it only briefly. Having received a bye through the preliminary round, Fiesta were tasked against reigning English champions Wolves. A 1-1 draw in Belgrade was followed by a 3-0 loss in England to see Zvezda fall at their first hurdle. While the domestic season prior had seen Zvezda almost imitate Dinamo when it came to throwing championships away, this season saw the Zagreb and Belgrade giants go head-to-head all season. Dinamo had waxed and waned across the entire decade, either challenging strongly or finishing nowhere. The 1960s will be a somewhat different decade for them, as much as we will get into Partizan's babies, Dinamo will have their own generation. A generation which could be seen to begin this season, one featuring the debut for Dinamo for Slaven Zambata, who would be a mainstay of the side for the next decade. This was a season which was genuinely a two-horse race. Zvezda and Dinamo pulled clear quickly and finished well ahead of Partizan and Vojvodina in third and fourth. It was Dinamo who finished the autumn top of the championship, having defeated Zvezda at Maksimir. The season would be decided in May. Dinamo had four matches, opening with draws against OFK and Vojvodina, before travelling down to Belgrade to face Partizan in the cup final. Dinamo would outplay the army side at the JNA, winning the cup 3-2 before travelling back up to Croatia for a decisive match in Split against Hajduk. That game, refereed by a Belgrade resident, would be a violent encounter. Multiple Dinamo players would end up injured, and Hajduk's Ante Zanetic would walk out of the game at half-time because of how he was being asked to play. Hajduk would win 2-1, and it would hand Zvezda an advantage they would not relinquish, winning the title by a point. This was the last season of the Zvezda era, and they were not to be denied. At this juncture, there are two things to point out before we sum up the 1950s. The first is that, going through that last season, it doesn't appear like Sven and Zvezda are getting much credit. In part, that's because the most written on this particular season comes from the Dinamo perspective, and there is a running thread through Dinamo interpretations that, while detailed, does tend to play up a victim complex a bit. However, what is hard to deny is that Dinamo did spend some of this decade being pretty hard done by, and, if anything, their appeal as nearly men was one of the traits that would make their successes all the sweeter. They came up against a Zvezda side that was the side of this generation. The second thing to talk about is about a person. At some point, we would have to crowbar in Ante Zanetic into the timeline and to make an excuse to talk about him. Zanetic isn't someone we would ordinarily spend a lot of time talking about. While extremely capable and a player good enough to be in both the Euro 1960 side and become an Olympic gold medalist, he was also part of a Hajduk side that was pretty poor and, as such, a side in the late 1950s who became a footnote because of their struggles. But Zanetic is, because of one action he took in 1961, one of the most important players for us to cover, and his dissatisfaction with how the league was allowed to proceed in this season is one of the factors behind that action. In 1960, Zanetic would make World Soccer's best World 11 of the year, and his last ever national team game would be that Olympic win. Come summer 1961, Zanetic ran. Yugoslavia had been short of defectors. A combination of lack of options to go to, Greece was in turmoil, and save the borders with Slovenia, there wasn't really another way to get out to a Western nation. Zanetic would arguably be the most famous Yugoslav defector of all. Prior to him, water polo player Ivo Štakala had simply stayed in Australia after the 1956 Olympics, and former mixed doubles Grand Slam winning tennis player Dragutin Mitic, who failed to return from a competition in Italy in 1952. For Zanetic, the breaking points came in two places. The first was in bringing a Serb as manager of Hajduk and the subsequent poisoning of the well between Hajduk and Dinamo, as exacerbated by that game at the close of the 59-60 season. Zanetic was famously taken out of the game as he refused to follow instructions during the game to violently take out Dinamo players. That very night, as a result, he would be followed home by three thugs paid by the club to beat him up, while the morning papers noted he had been in, quote, an accident. He essentially went on strike for a few months while concocting his plan to escape Yugoslavia, and signing a 5-year contract with Hajduk, reaffirming his commitment to the club and to the state, granted him the opportunity to go abroad to stage his escape. The second breaking point was that he had experienced discrimination against him in college, as his family had been members of the Ustasha's political party, the HSS, and he became aware of atrocities committed against Croatians at the close of the war. He was known to spend time in the dressing room telling teammates that Croatians should not be divided and that they should be against their Serb manager. Zanetic was close with the Torcida also. He was part of the crowd at their foundation and saw friends expelled from university for the crime of simply being a member of Hajduk's fan group. While Hajduk were on a mid-season tour of Germany in January 1961, Zanetic slipped away as the team were changing trains and fled. Hajduk returned to Yugoslavia to immediately host the club's 50th anniversary. Special guest at that dinner would be none other than Josip Broz Tito, attending that while the club were under the shadow of their best player having defected to the West a couple of days prior. Zanetic had timed his escape for maximum impact. He would hide out in a hotel in Dusseldorf before resuming his playing career in Belgium, having to be smuggled across the border from Germany with a fake passport under the name of Pedro Esteban, eventually settling in Australia for the remainder of his life after his playing career was cut short due to complications from his spina bifida. Much as the clubs who had been perceived to have crossed the Rubicon in support for non-communist causes pre-war saw themselves scrubbed out, so too did Zanetic. The very mention of his name was banned and removed from the records. It was not until the country fell apart that Zanetic was in any way rehabilitated, and it was not until 1995 that he would go back to visit. You can now visit his memorial mural on Kortula Island in his hometown of Blato. The 1950s themselves in Yugoslavia were a roaring success. The nation gained in stature, in wealth, and in relevance on the global stage. The national team were at world football's top table. When they went to tournaments, they would only be put out by the best sides in the world, be they the magical Magyars, World Cup winners Germany, or rivals of the USSR. Domestically, there would be a stable, healthy league, and the growth of continental football, with the Yugoslav sides being competitive in those cross-country competitions. The first half of the decade belonged to Hajduk, the second half to Zvezda Fiesta, but with the other members of the Big Four always there and always relevant, with Vojvodina coming through also. In the 1960s, much of this will change. Zanetic's defection was not the catalyst for unrest, but the reasons behind his choice would eventually fester amongst others. The downfall of Yugoslavia as a whole isn't on its way imminently, but we are approaching the point of history where we see the actions before the actions that do eventually cause the fall of the nation. Next time on the podcast. Zvezda Fiesta had already moved to the JNA, but it was time for the balance of power to shift to that stadium's normal occupants as the babies join the fray. Thank you for listening. Please hit the subscribe button if you haven't already. Please feel free to write a review on whatever podcast service you use. If you don't follow me already on Twitter, you can at Timo Mouse, TimoMouse. And I will see you all next time.